This is Ian Collinge, part 2 of 4, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee on the 29th of November 2015. Ian Collinge, part 2.
Let me just ask you a couple of questions on what we were talking about earlier. Particularly this project called SIRS, S-I-R-S. Just give me a bit more background on what that was about, how it worked.
The Signet Island reference sites were two areas on the Gourley Peninsula of Signet that had thermistors. This is in the early days of electronics, so thermistors inserted into the moss and leads that ran into the hut that I helped prepare at Monkswood. Although, to be fair, Pete Tilbrook's woodworking skills were much better than mine.
You built the hut in Britain?
Yeah, we insulated it more heavily. We had a heater for it. This was all very, in those days, very, very basic. So polystyrene insulation in the hut, a little paraffin heater. I mean, it was basic. And the electromechanical recorders recorded the temperature on paper charts. And it would measure the temperatures in the moss every, I forget what the interval was now, hour or something like that. And the thermistors were inserted at different levels. And in winter, in many ways, things were dormant, so less important. But in the summer, the blackbody temperature was astronomical. By Antarctic standards, in the same way that if you feel a husky, a piebald husky, in the sunshine, you put your hand on the black part of his coat, it'll be very warm. The white part will be noticeably cooler. So depending on what the moss cover was, the variation in temperature was huge. And what was interested, or what Bill and Pete were interested in, was, you know, what the range of temperatures was and what the mites did in those circumstances.
Did the mites move around to find an optimum temperature?
Yeah, they would have done. The reference sites kept going for 10 years. My successors continued running the equipment. But of course, the equipment was Grant recorders, and they were the first of their sort.
Grant,
G-R-A-N-T. This was the very early days of long-term monitoring.
Did it always work perfectly?
No, because the temperature was critical to the instruments as well. So that's why the hut was so heavily insulated, and why I would, particularly in cold weather, would go across from base to see that they were still working.
So the recorders were in the hut?
Yes.
But their probes, or whatever it was,
were some distance away. Guessing now, probably about 100, 200 metres away.
And it was temperamental, this gear, was it?
Yes, because it was very basic. And it was electromechanical. It wasn't way before the days of electronics.
So how were you able to establish that what you were getting were genuine results or genuine readings?
It was calibrated before it went south. So what it would produce were what the thermistors would do. We also had thermistors for the diving projects. Those weren't particularly miniature either. And they were measuring core temperatures. I digress, sorry.
No, go, please do, please do.
And two things you had to do. You had to swallow a radio pill, and in those days radio pills were large pills, and you had to wear a thermistor up your bum. And that was before the days of miniaturisation, so it was extremely uncomfortable.
Some quack had a bright idea for a research project.
Well, the doctors did do research programmes, and at Signet, this was in the summer. Although they looked after your health, they were given research programmes to do as well.
Just going back to the mosses then, the work you were doing there, Did you develop any knacks to make the equipment more reliable or to solve any problems that may arise?
Just keep the temperature up in the hut to make it work, because otherwise the instrument wouldn't work.
Okay.
And that was very basic.
Okay. What sort of changes do you think Dick Law instigated in his time at Monkswood?
Well, I think I mentioned earlier, when he first came, he recognised that biology, I'm sure he recognised, we never discussed this because I wasn't at that level, I was a little cog in the wheel, that bass botany had developed and grown to dwarf bass biology. Bass botany was then in Birmingham. To work on animals in the moss, for example, you'd want to involve botanists as well. So that was all part of what he brought together, particularly when it all happened. And the catalyst for all of that was coming together in Cambridge. He also wanted to develop, and did develop, bird and seal biology from the routine monitoring that was going on before. He also saw that there was three divisions within biology, freshwater, marine and terrestrial biology. So there was three subsections that's what he created and existed for some years.
Fuchs was not a scientist, Dick Laws was. So
no, Fuchs was a scientist.
He was a scientist, I beg his pardon.
He was a geologist, yeah.
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 Did you get a sense that Bass took its science more seriously under Dick Laws?
Before Dick Laws came on the scene, there's a chap called Martin Holgate, and he actually laid the foundation, and this is before this is something I've only read subsequently. He laid a lot of the foundations for serious science. Dick Laws took them on, and Nigel Bonner then further developed them. So it was an evolution. So I don't think Bass was an unscientific organisation before. Some people will say, I think perhaps unkindly, that Fuchs was the explorer and Dick Laws was a heavyweight scientist, which he certainly was. It's an exaggeration, really.
Too black and white.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And in each era of director, there's been a different course run. David Drury was far more PR aware than Dick Laws was. So each bring a different thing, as my old boss used to say, to the party.
Well, PR was more important in David Drury's era than it might have been in Dick Laws, really.
I think Bass then recognised that you had to influence people and culture people. Therefore, and he was very good at that. Or is very good at that. Dick was a serious scientist, but he was a man of each have been men of the time.
How serious was Ricky Chin?
Ricky, many ways. When I changed from biology to logistics, which I spent most of my career in Basel. Ricky, I think, was my mentor.
Really?
He was, I highly regarded him, very, very nice guy. He laid all the foundations for organising Bass Logistics. So he drew together lists of things. He was quite meticulous in the way that he worked, and he would never ask you to do something that he couldn't do himself. His upbringing in Bass Basses, beginning in 1961 at Deception. He was the first professional BC that Bass had in terms of King Edward Point, South Georgia. So he had a very good grounding in how the Bass Basses of that era worked. And he brought that to then London. and then took it on from there. So I nothing but the highest regard for him.
Were you mates?
Oh, yes, 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 yes. But not... Ricky was also a very private man. I got on extremely well with him. We were close colleagues and friends. I learned an awful lot from him. Probably more than I did from most people in my bus career.
He's such a private man, he managed to wriggle out of this process.
I tried to persuade him, actually.
Yeah.
Because he had things to offer that were unique, such as deception, for example, such as the early Halleys and South Georgia setting up, and the early days of Bass in Cambridge. So I did my level best because I thought he had a lot to offer. A lot to offer.
I think that it was a mixture of reluctance and also declining health.
I think it was reluctance.
I don't blame him.
He was always too nice a chap to say no, but he wouldn't do it. And I, particularly on deception, I tried to persuade him.
So there was this sea change in 1980 where you moved, not exactly sideways, but you transferred your work patterns from supporting scientists in one way to doing it another way, really. You tell me what happened in 1980. You got a new job at Bass. Did you have to apply for it, or would they appoint you internally, or what happened?
I was put.
You were made.
I didn't have any... poor old Nigel Bonner lost a member of staff. I mean, in these days, I guess it would have been fought for harder. The post was transferred and I was transferred with the post, and I was then graded professional and technical officer grade 3, and I was then regraded to an executive officer and lost money. They said it couldn't happen in the civil service. Well, it did.
A lot?
No.
Okay.
It was a principal.
You were transferred from Life Science Division to Admin / Logistics.
Yes.
Under Paul Whiteman. And Ricky Chin.
Yes. My immediate boss was Ricky. In addition to looking after the bioscience stuff, which I continued with, I was given other things to look after.
Everything?
Over the years, I did a whole range of things. And initially, it was things like provisions, food, which was completely new to me. I needed to know more about the other bases as well. Mm-hmm. In those days, Halley, Faraday and Rotherham.
So are we talking here about the annual provisioning of bases?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you had one shot, usually?
Yes. So you had to get it right. The way in which it was done was quite conservative. There was room for error because you depended on data that came from the base. So if the cook didn't count things very well or wasn't interested in counting things, and to be fair, if you go to the Antarctic, the last thing you want to do is count tins of baked beans, then things could go awry. They never went very badly awry, but you had to source provisions from a supplier. And traditionally, we had initially... quite long-term suppliers. You had to have it packed and marked and arrive at the docks, and you wanted as long a date on all of these provisions. So all of that had to be taken into consideration. And in those days, there were far less frozen provisions than there are today, ironically.
So it was a bit of a headache, was it, Ian?
It was new to me. I had a steep learning curve. Ricky was very good in helping me through it. That was really the first major store section that I took on. It needed to be got right. You had to calculate You had to be sure that the data that you were putting in to the system, and it was a very basic system, simply a list with however many baked beans per man, tin of baked beans per man per year. So it was very, very simple.
Was it computerised by 1980?
No.
Ledgers.
Long, long way from it. In fact, it never did get very computer. We used spreadsheets, but it never did get very complicatedly computerised.
When people say it was a steep learning curve, they usually mean there were lots of early errors. Can you think of things that went astray early on before you managed to
I can't remember what it was now, but I remember a supplier saying, did you really want 3 tonnes of whatever it was? And I looked at it and said, well, actually, no, thanks for pointing that out. and we worked very closely with suppliers as well, because there was a kind of, it was very much a two-way thing. As for many of the things that you get for bass, it's a two-way street. They want to support you as well as you wanting them to supply the goods. I wish I could remember what it was, but these things happen. But the last thing you want is to have to close a base through lack of baked beans.
Okay. Joe has asked me for quite a lot of detail on this, so I'm going to have to ask you to talk me through it, really, as to how you went about requisitioning and procurement and packing and shipping. Talk me through the process. How do you find a supplier for a certain product?
Well, let's go through the annual cycle as far as the bases is concerned first. And that is that the whole range of indents, there was about nearly 40 indents.
Per base?
Yes. Store section one was provisions. And then it went 2, 3, 4, 5, all the rest of it. So each specific need of supply had its own list, which was an indent. And each year, people would ask for darkroom chemicals or beakers or a main bearing for the generator. It could be a whole range of things. And it would be listed. You'd ask for it on this indent, except for provisions. All we wanted from them then was how much there was on station, and that would have been counted during the Antarctic summer. Then it would be multiplied up dependent on the number of people that you've got there for the summer and the winter, and then in addition to that, you had to also calculate how much would be consumed in the intervening time, and also allow for a 6-month reserve as well. So that was the calculation. So you would either ask for something or at least give the stock on base. Now that varied a lot from section to section. Mm-hmm. The quality of the data varied as well, which is why we went south and looked, and why if we didn't, we thought something was awry, we'd ask them to count it again. And also, the base commander should have been involved in this process as well, and had a chat or a glance through what was being asked for. It would arrive in Cambridge when the ships got back. Yeah, this is long before transmission of data.
Can I interject one question? Wouldn't some of these supplies actually be under snow?
Well,
they were trying to count supplies. Wouldn't some of them be actually under snow?
No.
Was that earlier?
No, most things were countable in that sense.
That was a previous era.
That wasn't an issue really.
So the ship came back with the information on.
Yes, you would then look at it, look at the sense of it, and in the case of provisions, multiply it up. That would then produce a set of purchase orders. But before you get to that stage, you've got to identify where you're going to go shopping. Now, for provisions, over the years, we used several different suppliers. But the suppliers had to be cultivated because you wanted latest dates on everything, because virtually everything that you consume in terms of food in the Antarctic is out of date, because it will be. So sell by dates and display by dates go by the board. But you do want it as late as possible. So you persuade them to, well, first of all, to tender for it. So you go out and say, right, this is what we want this year. You would have a preferred supplier rather than go to three different companies, because that would just be a nightmare to administer, because you potentially got a new company every year.
So you didn't do competitive tendering?
We did.
You did?
But you would get a preferred supplier and he would supply you for a number of years, and then you would want to go to the market again. But when you get a preferred supplier, you would go to them and you'd say, this is what we want this year. And in terms of any big things like provisions, like timber, like fuel, the supplier would pack and mark it. Now, that sounds simple, but you've got to find means of packing it. Because a food supplier it's not the trade that they're in, it's not something they would normally do. Same with a timber supplier. You would want it to be identifiable, so it needs to be marked clearly with where it's going and store section and all the rest of it. Identify numbers on the outside so that the ships know where to stow it, and when it gets into the docks, where to put it so it's stowed in order. So that's all. That process has got to be managed. They then pack it as late as possible and send it to the docks on a specific day. We would ask it to come forward for the cargo to be assembled for that particular ship, and that would be just prior to that ship's sailing. So there isn't a quayside shed which things arrive through the summer. It all arrives at once, because you don't rent a shed for the summer, you rent it for a week.
I'm beginning to get worried already. Sounds like a dangerous thing to do.
This is what Ricky was so good at. The supplier then packs it, or in the case of smaller suppliers, they would send it to a packing store. And again, we would have a preferred supplier for packing stores that would last us for several years. Then we would go to the market, because a supplier would receive a note of what's coming, a copy of the order. They would have to identify it, check it off. If there's discrepancies, go back to the supplier and say, what's up? Then pack it to the specification that you want. And bear in mind that you're packing everything from tin of baked beans through to dangerous chemicals for a bio lab.
All on the same ship?
Yes. Mm. Through to explosives. Mm. That's what flares and things are. Well, and bullets and stuff. I've even received in the quayside rockets, big rockets. Each box, 21 of them, big boxes about, I suppose there must have been about 7 or 8 foot long. Each one had my name on it. It's all very sinister. It happened in the middle of the night, because we had to have a special dispensation to load these rockets when there was nobody about. So it was like a scene out of James Bond, you know.
Well, there's genuine danger, was there?
Oh, yes. Yes. These were class one explosives, yeah. And we used explosives for seismics as well. So, yeah, we were packing.
Very brave ship's captain.
You had to use your common sense. But on the James Clark Ross, there is a proper magazine, and there are demountable magazines to stow on deck. So all that was taken extremely seriously. But here you are with a ship that's got an awful lot of fuel, an awful lot of drummed fuel, an awful lot of miscellaneous chemicals and explosives. Great. And this is a side that most people, of course, don't see. And why should they? I'm not complaining about that.
So okay, well, let's pursue this a little bit then. Your job is to make sure the ship gets to the Antarctic in one piece. So how do you actually arrange that kind of cargo so that there isn't going to be a problem?
The man who's responsible for the cargo to the captain is a chief officer. The chief officer is responsible for stowing it. For any cargo that's stowed on bash ships or any ship for that matter, there are clear instructions of what you may put next to you. You don't put the detonators next to the explosives because that's not a sensible thing to do. You wouldn't put the explosives in the middle of a stove of fuel drums. He will decide and has the authority to decide on that. But the role of Ricky and what subsequently became mine was that you had to go to the chief officer with a whole mixed cargo and say, right, the itinerary says this, this and this, you know, in terms of where they're going when. And this, therefore, this you would want the last cargo off to be the first cargo on. But sometimes you want an option, for example, Bird Island, because you're unloading in mid-ocean. If you can't get in at Bird Island, you don't really want to overstow the South Georgia cargo, so that's got to be stowed elsewhere. So there's all these things that, that evolve through experience of both ship's crew, particularly the mate, and the person sorting out the cargo, which was Ricky and then became me. Ricky developed that side of things to a fine art, and I inherited it. And I was, you know, I inherited already a well-established system, which was very good. Ricky said that he could have loaded a ship himself, and I believe at the end I could as well, because you're doing it every year. But it is the strength of the resupply of the bases is that it's an annual cycle.
Yes, it's repetitive.
Yes. So you will get the odd 21 boxes of rockets, but they're not the norm. But when you come across that, you've got to factor it in and deal with it.
You've also got to get the stuff assembled on the quay side in a safe manner as well, because it could just go off there instead of coming.
Again, for example, we came away from Southampton in the 80s. Because it was getting more and more difficult to load there. Docks labour wasn't good. It was in the days of the docks labour scheme, and a weak set of employers and a very dominant set of dockers. The docks labour scheme was abolished, and we went to Grimsby. I think the ships were... Ricky did it then, the first few years, but the ships were loaded with much more ease at half the cost, because there was no restrictive practices.
So what was going wrong prior to your moving the process to Grimsby? What sort of problems were you experiencing under the collapse of the system in Southampton?
Well, it didn't collapse, but the docks labour there were took things by the book, so they weren't reliable. If there was, for example, a union meeting, your labour would vanish. And they would prescribe the number of dockers. Well, if you're loading a small amount of cargo, you don't want an army of dockers. But that's not how it was then. Went to Grimsby, and it was tailored for the cargo that you were loading.
So the unions were less powerful at Grimsby, is that the difference?
No, the docks labour scheme was abolished. So there was much more freedom over who was employed and under what terms. Actually, the Labour lost out because it was then very much down to who was employing them, and they didn't want militants, so they were paid off, and that was the end of it.
So you're requisitioning food, for example. Would you requisition all foodstuffs from the same company, or would you get your baked beans from Company A and your tomato ketchup from a different company?
You have all your what was called dry provisions from one company. Sometimes it worked out to be both, but often dry provisions from one company. And in my time, there were several companies used. Your frozen provisions, and that increased over the years, possibly from another company. And as I say, in my time, you would use a company and then you would want to verify that you're still getting good service, and you need both, a good price and good service. And that wasn't an easy job to do. And that wasn't an easy job to select for packing companies, because it was way out with their experience to receive such a wide range of goods in a relatively short time. Same with provisions companies. Provisions companies want to supply the baked beans through the year. They don't want just one shot.
A lump.
In September, because that doesn't do the business any good.
So were they dropping... Would the company sometimes just drop out because it was just too much hassle for them? Or was there a certain pride to be had from prestige, perhaps?
Oh, there was certainly from packing companies there was prestige. But we, over the years, dealt with a whole range, several packing companies. You had to explain in some detail, and there was a lot of bedding in because they were receiving things from all over the place. They had to identify them, they had to pack them, and they had to mark them exactly as we wanted them, because we wanted to be able to identify, we wanted the packaging to withstand the trip, we wanted to be able to identify it clearly so it wasn't going to get mixed up with anything else, and we wanted identifiable when it was unpacked, actually on station.
So was there, from your point of view, a degree of resistance to going to a new supplier because all that history is lost?
Too right.
Yeah.
Particularly if you felt that it was going well. But there would be pressure to by any auditor to check on that. So it evolved to be preferred suppliers for both packaging and for supply. For good reason, but it also you couldn't. I mean, I can think of one supplier of servicer of outboard motors, and they were just bloody hopeless. So you know, you can't tolerate it. You have to find somebody else. So that's very much an unseen side of Bass. When you're actually drawing the cargo together, this happens over a very few days. You could receive cargo for a matter of as little as 2 or 3 days. Everything would arrive, the whole lot. You would have to check it off. You'd have to separate it out, and also separate it out safely in the sheds, because there are health and safety rules there. And you've got everything from compressed gases to fuels to lab chemicals, to medical supplies. So you want to be able to clearly check that you've got everything, that it's in the right place in the shed, and that your mate is going to come across and see it. I mean, you'd have talked before this anyway, but your mate's going to come across and see it. And then between you, have a loading program.
Yeah.
That sounds a bit grand, but, you know, a plan. To load it in order. And we developed things, particularly in Grimsby. We weren't at Grimsby for all of my career. We did vary. We did end up down on the south coast, and that was a calamity, because Grimsby had developed the expertise for loading. And it sounds like loading a cargo is dead easy. It's not, because you've got cardboard boxes, you've got wooden boxes, you've got very heavy things, very light things. You wouldn't want your cornflakes underneath a generator, for example. But once you've loaded your cargo, you've got to secure it as well. And that is, if you've got, as we did have, 1,000 drums of aviation fuel, 45-gallon drums, that takes quite a lot of skill to secure. And you certainly don't want cargoes moving.
So this is pre-container, or were you using containers by the time?
The answer to that is yes and no. You can't handle a container at Sydney or Bird Island.
Of course not.
Or really at South Georgia. The only place you could handle a container, but not all the time, is Halle and Rothera.
But they're a handicap rather than a help, aren't they?
They can be. A full container of food, for example, would be, you know, could possibly be 20 tons. So there are limits to what you can put on the sea ice, even at Halley. Depends on the sea ice, the quality of the sea ice. And the Bass ships at present have got a limited container capacity. And of course, ships are now virtually all containerized for the expertise for loading what's called break bulk, which is bits of cargo, has gone from the ports because nobody does it anymore. Well, one exception to that might be the St. Helena ship, but there are exceptions. But the old days of securing cargoes, receiving, stowing, and securing cargoes of that sort have long since gone.
So the job got harder because of progress.
In that sense, yes. But Grimsby and Immingham, which operate as the same port, still had a gang of dockers that you could trust to load the ship.
What was the catastrophe on the south coast?
We went to where was it? I forgot the name of the port. Chesil Beach, just over the beach.
Pool?
Not Pool.
Weymouth? Bridport?
Oh, hang on, Weymouth. Where the sailing championships were for the Olympics. Is that Weymouth?
Yeah, I think so. We can correct this later if you think
Portland, that's where it was.
Portland.
Yeah, which was a big naval base. The quality of dockers they had there was appalling. They had no cranes. It was a portable crane, so that's not like a dockside crane, or not operated in the same way. And securing cargo of that sort, they had no experience of. They had to bring people from miles away.
So why did you go there?
Because it was insisted that we tried it.
By whom?
In this case, my boss.
Oh, right.
Which was, at that time, John Pye.
But a NERC boss? Or?
No. Bass Head of Admin.
Okay.
And a new person who came in to manage the ships. The ship happened to be there. Why don't we go down there to load it? Why do we assemble all the cargo there? Well, so we did try it, and it didn't work.
So what would happen if, for example, the baked beans arrived the day after the ship was due to sail? Because some of the time, it's such a tight window of departure, isn't it? So there must have been occasions where you had to leave without something.
If something hadn't arrived, you would chase it up so it could arrive and you know, maybe a even tighter, but it would get there. There weren't many cases of that, but we did have a fallback in that the Falkland Island ships, resupply ships, did go once a month. And we could send cargo to the Falklands to be picked up. And in fact, this became, to a degree, a routine. I don't know how it is now. But that can be fraught with difficulty if there's a problem with their ship. So you're placing your trust in a third party then, and indeed for the rebuild of South Georgia, we happened upon a very amenable company that was prepared to send their ship to be loaded with the South Georgia structures in Sweden. Malmo, and then come here, load their own cargo for the Falklands, discharge that, and then go on to South Georgia. So that was quite a coup, really.
How did that happen? How did you find the company?
It was the shipping line that then was currently shipping this stuff, and I talked to the man there, and he produced a ship that was big enough for both cargoes.
I can't help thinking, whilst we're talking about this, that actually you're a biology science technician. That's your career, and yet here you are doing something completely different in your life now.
Yes, and I learned it when I moved across, and spent most of my life doing that. My life with Bass, I'm doing that.
So was the move because life was changing, or was it because it was a new challenge for you? What was it was an attraction for less money?
Actually, the shipping side, well, I suppose, I once said to Frank Curry, either you have a career or work for Bass. and that tripped out of my mouth without me thinking about it, really. So my career happened. It wasn't planned. But I suppose in moving to logistics, I had I didn't see it at the time, but I did have a career path.
FID tenant, wasn't there, that if a job needs to be done,
exactly,
you do it.
Yeah, and FIDs generally are highly motivated people because it's fun doing what you do, and also if you get it wrong, it's quite apparent that you get it wrong, so you try not to, because a lot of the responsibility is yours. Autonomy was great. I very much like that side of things. And through my career in logistics, I moved from food to clothing. Clothing was really interesting. I enjoyed doing that.
Well, I'd like to talk about clothing in a minute. But finish your point. I'll come back to that.
I was just thinking I did a whole range of purchasing, which actually, when I moved to shipping, I didn't want to move to shipping because I was quite enjoying what I was doing. And I didn't really know anything about shipping because Ricky did it all. And he was very good at it.
Before we move to clothing, were there occasions where you actually did have to kind of push the boat out, metaphorically, by going and getting a special ship? I'm thinking there were occasions, I think, when you had to use Russian ships to do with the Halley.
In terms of shipping, that was probably one of the most challenging jobs I had, because Halley 6 was a huge volume. Bass ship annually about, when I left, roughly 5,000 cubic metres of cargo a year, which is about the capacity of both ships, roughly. Maybe a little bit more. The Halley cargo, in very round numbers, Halley 6 cargo, was about 25,000 cubic metres to be shipped initially on one ship.
Mm.
But the production of the building didn't happen, so it had to be two ships. And each ship that was chartered is, in round figures, about £1 million.
£1 million? Okay.
And myself and Steve Lucas, who I work closely with, did all that with an expert shipping man at our side, because chartering ships can lead you into all sorts of mischief, because if you've agreed to something and the ship sinks, then you're in all sorts of pickles. So and shipping charters are arcane and probably fascinating, but alarming to the likes of me. So we spent a long time selecting. Well, there wasn't a huge choice, and heart in mouth that the ship would turn up when it did, and heart in mouth that it would work. You know, the bottom. I mean, these were quite ancient ships. They were multi-role, ice-strengthened supply ships of a certain class. So that site, actually getting the ship, was a major task. And then loading it was an even more major task, because here we were loading in a port that wasn't familiar, Cape Town. Loading bits of steel lattice, about 10 by 20 metres, and there was about 8 of them. So devised a system of putting those on deck with container slots. Big lumps of hugely insulated plastic. Some of those were 5 by 10 meters. I mean, big bits. All sorts of awkward shapes. You've seen pictures of Halley 6. Well, you can imagine that all the bits,
the legs for a start,
didn't fit too well together. In a port that was not familiar with, it turns out, a workforce that had been recruited from bus stops around Cape Town. Some of these boys had never been on a ship before. Most of them were dying of AIDS. Slinging very difficult things, actually hooking them on and putting them in the ship's hold. We had 3 serious accidents. They dropped a forklift truck from the sling into the hold. They dropped one of the panels into the hold, and we had a fatal accident. Somebody fell into the hold. So that was a tough time, really tough time. I had with me one of the Bathship's masters, and he was, well, he was excellent.
Who was this?
It was, his name's gone out of my head.
Nick Beer?
No.
Ian Lawrence?
No, no.
Don't worry, it'll come.
It will come. And Brian, his name's gone out of my head as well. The contractors were Morrison, and their head of logistics, was Brian Newham, was superb. We worked very well together. And we learned such a vast amount on the first load that the second load, which was even more difficult in terms of getting everything on, worked well because we didn't have the same workforce. We stopped and made sure everything was done in order and safely. So it worked the second time around.
Where were you? Were you in South Africa? Or you
yes,
in Cambridge?
I went out. No, I went out to set it up. I was involved in several meetings in South Africa before we actually loaded the ship, because we needed a vast area to store the stuff, and we needed time in that area to have it brought there. 25,000 cubic meters is a lot of cargo. John Harper was the name of the bus captain. Excellent, super practical guy who worked his way up from an AB to captain. He still is captain. But my God, we had it tough there. And I, when I was planning this, he happened to be drifting through the canteen at Bass. And I said, John, do you like cabbage? And he said, yes. I said, I've got just a job for you. So he was, I mean, he was tremendous help, as Brian was. He took on the job. He sailed with the ship, and Brian sailed with the ship. And I was appalled when they took on stores. This is something else we learned, because the quality of the food on board wasn't wonderful. So we improved that the second time around. So, but included with the food in the first trip was this great mountain of cabbage. Alongside, I saw this cabbage mountain growing. And they joined the ship after we'd loaded it, and they went on board and I went on board to say cheerio, and they were having the first meal. I said, what is it, John? It was cabbage soup.
Sounds like it's a miracle that anything ever got south ever. You must have had a guardian angel.
The Halley 6 job was a very interesting one. It was tough as well. And we were working 10, 12-hour days. Very, very hard. It gets windy. There's a southwest wind. And these huge panels would get blown about, and then it was dangerous. And we only just got it all on.
Was that the Russian vessel?
Yes.
So how do you go about procuring or hiring a Russian vessel? I mean, presumably there's a hell of a lead time.
Yes. Oh, you start to charter a ship that you want, as we did in November, December time. You would start looking in spring. And you would need to have confidence it would turn up, because they'd be looking for cargoes to position their ship. Otherwise, you've got positioning costs as well. So, do you want some more tea? It was quite fraught.
Did you sleep much?
I never.
Did it get to you?
No, I never have any trouble sleeping.
Okay. But you had to choose a new route as well at times, didn't you? When you were going for the Halley 6 supply,
it became a routine. Actually, Cape Town is a better jumping off point. So I believe Shackleton still goes to Cape Town en route south. So she'll go usually the Humber, Cape Town, Halley.
That was a new devised route.
It had been done before. I had actually joined Bransfield in Cape Town before. Mm. But it was relatively unused, yeah. Yeah.
There would have been occasions, I think, when, apart from having to hire extra vehicles, there were occasions when you couldn't actually get to a base.
Yeah.
Tell me about... the Halley, I think Halley was difficult to relieve.
That happened, yeah.
In 2001, 2002.
Yeah. But it had 6 months reserve of food. No, a year, sorry, reserve of food. So, only essential things were shipped by air, by Twin Otter, from the ice shelf across to Halley.
Such as, what sort of things would be essential?
Science gear, medical gear as well. Thinking of medical gear, that was a steep learning curve as well. There was the option of selecting out. But if you had a ship loaded with the medical gear on the bottom, it's not as easy as it sounds.
Well, if you have a ship loaded with food and you get almost as far as Halley and can't get in, the ship turns back. A, you've got lots of food you can't use, and B, the next ship you need, to because they'll be using up their reserves, you need a bigger ship next time, don't you?
Because it'll have more. Although the food in terms of volume is not huge in terms of ships.
It's okay.
What we would have done then is to send the food to somewhere like Rothera, which has got a huge, 100-plus... summering, it would get consumed pretty quickly anyway. You can move things around in that way. The same thing happens if you can't deliver fuel to either Halley or Rothera or wherever. You can find a place to stockpile it, and there's always the option of discharging it in Stanley to store.
So you never brought it back to Britain?
No.
But you would still have the problem that if you couldn't relieve the base that summer, then they would be using up their reserves.
Yes,
and
they
need to send more material next time.
Yes, yes, yeah. And the same is true of reserves of fuel at Halley for the same reason. Mm. Yeah.
Did he ever have to do special deliveries, like sending a man with a machine or a propeller or...
I think certainly for bits of aircraft, it wouldn't be the first time that somebody has been sent... clutching whatever it was to deliver it, usually to Punta Arenas, for a Twin Otter to fly it south to the Twin Otter that's stranded.
That was safer than putting it on a ship, or just more or just faster.
It's much, much faster.
Yeah.
And of course, the reverse is true. We've also shipped out the Twin Otters when they blew over, so they were dismantled and loaded on Bransfield.
Brought back.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've got this visual image of the ship arriving at Halley and all these FIDs standing in line throwing boxes to each other. Is that how it was done? Chain gang? Was that the ideal way of doing it?
No. What happens is that usually the sea ice is there. You hope that the sea ice is there, because if it's not, you might have to travel quite long distances to get the food to Halley. And the sea ice goes out each year. The ship would be discharged... as the stow. I mean, going back to Halley 6, the other complication about the structure was that there were some bits that were needed first. Mm. So there was three priorities, and you couldn't overstow some bits because they were needed first. The order was really quite critical. The actual order of discharge in that case was critical. In the resupply of a base, it would be you may separate out hazards, but the rest would be stowed in a usually fuel on the bottom, drummed fuel on the bottom, and the rest following that up. But of course, there are certain things that you can't stow next to drummed fuel, for example, flour, because it taints. So you've got to bear all these things in mind as well.
We were going to talk about clothing, weren't we? You started off wearing thick woolly pullovers issued at Stanley. I guess that had changed a great deal by the time you left your post at Bass. How did clothing evolve, how did you go about making sure it did evolve?
it's it probably started before I took it over, but initially, when I first went south, a large proportion of the clothing was made for Bass. The shirts were made for Bass. The anoraks were made for Bass. The shirts were a wool mix, scratchy as hell. The anoraks and windproof trousers were ventile, which is excellent for proper Antarctic use. But from the more northerly bases, it had to be waterproof as well. Moleskin trousers were made specifically for Bass. Boots weren't, but that constituted quite a lot of the clothing. Woolly pulleys were in time replaced by fleece. And of course, there was a huge change in what was available commercially. Breathable fabrics were around or becoming around. The consideration with clothing, though, was that although you were equipping people to go to a cold climate and climb and ski and all the rest of it, you're also equipping them to work on snowcats, you're equipping them to work on buildings. So there were, in addition to the Antarctic element, there was an industrial element. So you had to bear that in mind. So you couldn't use the latest flashy ski gear because it would last 5 minutes in a by a mechanic working on snowcats. Ventile was very good for that, a natural material which was pretty much unbreakable, but it was no good when it was, well, it didn't work as well when it was wet. So there was an evolution from things that were made specifically for Bass through to what was commercially available because the market had changed. So that when I left off doing clothing, although we did design waterproof, breathable fabrics, specifically with salopettes and anoraks, much of what Bass was using when I left was commercially available.
But had there been a period when Bass would produce a specification, a design, and send it to a manufacturer and say, make this?
Yes. And that's still true of tents and sledges, which are made of the same fabric, ventile, cotton ventile. So, yes, there was. And that evolved with manufacturers. I worked with several manufacturers creating designs of anoraks and salopettes. In the old days, you would want anoraks and windproof trousers to be quite baggy because you're running with dogs. You'd want them to vent. But sat on a skidoo, immobile, you'd want them more tailored. But on the other hand, you would want to be able to have to use your outer layer with a lot of insulation or little insulation, depending on what you were doing and where you were. So all of those things had to be borne in mind.
So at no time would you nip down to Millets in Cambridge and buy some anoraks? That was never...
No. I mean, when I was buying clothing, the clothing budget then was probably something like a couple hundred thousand a year. So you were able to approach companies and say, you know, can you do this for us? And we had a turnover of, I suppose, a small outdoor shop. Boots were a particular problem. We had to go quite widely. We had to go to Canada. We had to go to Italian plastic boots. We had to go to industrial boots with toe caps. So there had to be a range of boots, and those were Canadian as well, because that doesn't exist in the UK largely. And also, you had to plan for these things in plenty of time, because the market for cold weather boots depends on the Northern Hemisphere. So you had to think about it before and get your orders in before their cycle, because it was the opposite.
How did the concept of layered clothing start to emerge?
That very way before my time, and to do it to a degree, it was superseded because Down was increasingly used. Synthetic insulations were increasingly used. So you could put on a skidoo suit and layer it with a ventile over layer. But certainly in the earlier days, you would need to be able to do that because you would be working in a variety of circumstance, particularly around a base, where you'd be working hard, therefore you wouldn't want layers, but you might well want a windproof overlayer. Or you were sat immobile on, the other example is sat immobile on a skidoo, where you really do want a lot of insulation.
But the principle of moving to several layers, it still stands, doesn't it?
Because, yes.
You can stay warmer with more layers.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and flexible.
Yes, you can just take some off.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that was that evolution had taken place before you got the job. You feel you kind of you arrived and that was already in place.
It was, yes. Mm. I mean, the layer principle was well established.
What about moving from natural materials or fabrics to man-made fabrics?
That was quite interesting. Man-made fabrics don't do well in often don't do well in industrial environments. So you can wreck your Gore-Tex anorak on the exhaust of a vehicle, or by covering grease and oil and stuff. Ventile is pretty bomb-proof. It also drapes better, although you do get synthetics that drape better, so it contour to you far better. There's no substitute for down as far as insulation is concerned, but of course that's terribly fragile. So again, you tackle your skidoo engine or whatever in a down suit, you'll wreck it pretty quickly. So you've got to bear, and also in a marine environment, Gore-Tex and things initially didn't work well either. And again, ship's crew and stuff, they'll be working at Halley, but they'll also be working when it's wet and cold at Signy. So you do want to have something that's going to withstand the occupation and the environment and its a range of environments.
So there wasn't really a shift from natural to man-made. The man-made came in and occupied a position beside natural materials.
It did
you,
for a
you
long time.
You worked with both.
Yes. Yeah.
And is that not the case now still?
I don't know because I haven't been there for 4 years. But
so when you left, they were side by side.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And did fashion matter?
I had
colours.
I had one when females first went south. Something that should have happened years before it actually did. But when it did, a girl who I know well who went on a geology trip to James Ross Island, but she was a secretary, marvelled at when she was kitted out, nothing actually matched. And I took that as a compliment, really.
But did it change? Did you start having to be fashion aware? I'm not suggesting you watch the Paris boardwalks or catwalks, but was there a natural tendency to make it more attractive, the clothing?
I held a view for a while that it was actually the opposite was better because people would walk off with it less. So if you give them pink anoraks, they're less likely to stick that in their bag and cart it home to impress the girlfriend because it was pink. So no is a short answer to that.
Wasn't everything red anyway, for obvious reasons?
You do want something that's visible. And latterly, we did want, and this was probably after the time I was looking, it was after the time I was looking at after clothing, we wanted corporate logos and stuff on it, particularly when you're going to have film crews and so on down. You know, that becomes important.
So the Union Jack crept in, did it?
Yeah, but it crept in also for a good reason, because I remember somebody telling me of some film that the, I can't remember who it was, but another country was showing, and it was footage of a British operation. So after that, the Union Jack got plastered on a bit more, but that was really after the time I was dealing with clothing, where influencing people and visibility and identity became important, more important than.
So will the Bass logo appear on?
Yes, yeah. Yes, latterly, yeah.
The systems for requisitioning and procuring did change over time. Computerisation did come in, but NERC also put pressure upon you, I believe, to start outsourcing some of this procurement processes to the shared service centre in Swindon. Is that the case?
Probably one of the biggest calamities that's ever happened to Bass, certainly as far as logistics is concerned.
Tell me more.
Because for good reason, they wanted to centralise back office functions, one of which was procurement. Arguably, because I became involved in it with the other research councils, I could see that the procurement done by the other research councils varied, and some of it was crikey, alarming, really. Particularly when you consider that at that time, those research councils had budgets of 600 million. So Bass developed procurement so that you had expertise in the commodities that you were buying. There was a split at an earlier stage after 82 where the people who looked after the mechanical and engineering side went off and specified it. And then we looked after buying it, because there's a logical split in that. But the domestic things like food, fuel, clothing, all of those things were still done. So you specified it and you sourced it as a single person. So you became expert in whatever you were doing. So we developed expertise in all of the size of procurement. Nobody else in the research councils were buying anoraks, or Antarctic anoraks, certainly, specifying tents, specifying the sort of provisions that we were doing. So that has largely gone by the board. I don't know how it works now.
You saw it change.
I saw it change. And we, where we wanted to fuel a ship, you needed to do it quickly because you didn't want the ship stopped. They didn't, the sort of ponderous machine that was created didn't respond to that because it isn't the business that they were in. The NERC would have wanted Bass to be no different to anybody else because that's the way that they think. So a hugely complicated electronic system was put in place, and I tried to limit the damage that was done by that, and huge damage was done. The damage limitation was leaving one person, Steve Lucas, who's about to retire prematurely because he's so pissed off with the SSC or whatever it's called now, to get things like fuel, the big complicated procurements he understood and could do. But he got it all done despite the new thing that was put in place, not because of. Bass procurement was incredibly efficient. Procurement and cargo shipping was incredibly efficient. Now it's probably a lot less efficient.
You must have been saying that kind of thing. Were they listening to you?
All you could do is fight the odd battle. The war was lost before it was ever waged. It was never waged. You could only fight and win the odd battle, like having somebody like Steve Lucas, like having it phased in. But in fact, it's all happened anyway. So a lot of control was lost. A lot of expertise was lost. I don't think there is anything that's been gained as far as bus procurement is concerned by this.
Were you lost as well? Was that why you left?
My post wasn't replaced. I took retirement for personal reasons and wanted to go then. But I'm very glad that I didn't stay and see the mess that was made and the attempt to, very shortly after that, to demolish Bass by the head of NERC, which was appalling.
you've been working very hard. I think we should reconvene in the morning.
Okay, okay.
Thank you very much.